At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Item one today, immigration policy is really labor policy by other means. Item two, and unrelated, the story of the La La Land soundtrack is pretty interesting, actually. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco today at KQED, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you along, everybody, as it always is. Let's just stipulate right up at the top here, shall we, that it is going to be years, seriously, years before the full economic impact of President Trump's immigration enforcement policies become clear. That said, there are some things we can know right now, and one of those things is that this is going to be, and sooner rather than later, too, it's going to be a labor market story in a whole lot of parts of this economy. Marketplace's Annie Baxter gets us going today with agriculture and construction.
Angel Gomez installs drywall in the Chicago area. It's hard work, for which, Gomez says, general contractors often hire guys like him from Mexico.
It's a lot of dust all the time. Not many people want to deal with the dust, so Latinos are the ones doing the dirty job.
Gomez has a green card, but he says a lot of drywall guys are undocumented. Ditto for about 13% of the construction workforce. So says housing economist Elliot Eisenberg. He says deporting those workers would aggravate a construction labor shortage, mean less home construction, and higher prices.
We already have a housing affordability problem. We're not building enough houses. This is just going to make it worse.
Folks in agriculture have similar fears. Christy Boswell is with the American Farm Bureau Federation. She says about half the ag workforce is undocumented. Domestic workers aren't so interested in farm work.
Very well-intentioned domestic individual may not want to travel to rural part of the country to take a 6-week to 8-week seasonal harvest job.
The Farm Bureau estimates stricter immigration enforcement could increase fruit and vegetable prices about 5%. But such downsides could be offset by benefits. So says Stephen Camerata. He's with the conservative Center for Immigration Studies.
If the illegal immigrants left, it would increase the bargaining power of legal immigrants and native-born people who are in those sectors.
Still, many economists say the U.S. is already at about full employment, which makes them wonder where those domestic-born workers would come from to fill in the gaps. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
We did a story back in the waning days of the Obama administration about how the White House had hustled to lock into place its higher automobile fuel efficiency standards through 2025. That came as a bit of a shock to car makers who had expected they would get a chance to revisit those rules before they were finalized. But now with a new sheriff in town at the EPA, Detroit is asking for its do-over. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that story.
Back in 2011, the government was still bailing out struggling automakers. Brett Smith of the Center for Automotive Research says that gave it a pretty big chip to play.
The automotive industry had asked a lot of the federal government and wasn't really in a position to say no to anything.
So when the government asked to boost fuel efficiency standards by 2025, they complied. But Smith says they knew there'd be a chance to reassess the last 4 years of the standards when MPG requirements really take off.
car companies referred to the midterm evaluation as the off-ramp. It was their chance, in essence, to go back and lessen the 22 through 25 regulations.
That's why they really didn't like it when the EPA finalized things way earlier than expected. Gloria Bergquist is with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers.
We have some consumer buying trend studies in progress that we're just concluding now, and we would like them to be part of the record.
Bergquist says gas has gotten a lot cheaper, and
consumers are less interested in buying the most fuel-efficient vehicles on sale today.
And because the standards focus on cars actually sold and not on what's offered, Bergquist says the industry is less likely to hit targets. But Roland Huang of the Natural Resources Defense Council says automakers already get some leeway for larger vehicles.
So if you sell bigger cars or bigger trucks, then you automatically get flexibility in your standard.
Huang says the NRDC will fight against revisiting the matter using any option available. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was a split decision, narrowly split, we should say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so other than political prognostication, what industry do you suppose is coming off its worst year in almost four decades? Here's a hint, although really it's practically given it away. Coal. Coal mining is the thing. The president has promised, as you know, in his words, to revive coal. But in the cities and towns of coal country in this economy, there is some evidence that the mines really aren't an economic plus in the long term. Marketplace's Scott Tong took a trip to the coal fields of southern Illinois for us.
It seems a ridiculous question, really. How could a natural resource be bad for an economy? Judy Kellen of Saline County in southern Illinois puts it this way. She lives next door to a big coal mine with very big trucks.
Without a drop of coal here, we would have been better off because we would have had productive corn ground, soybean ground. We're not going to have productive nothing here. And it won't be until the Lord comes back.
Kellen comes from a mining family and says dissing coal in these parts is dissing your grandfather. But to her, all the blasting and the digging have wrecked the farming soil for good.
God's not going to make any more ground. I'll guarantee you I'm not a tree hugger, but I have lived with them in my front door.
Them as in coal companies. In energy economics, there's a big fancy term called the resource curse. It tries to understand why so many places rich in coal and oil turn out to be poor. That is the case in the bottom tip of Illinois. Incomes are lower than the rest of the state here, and poverty is higher, in towns literally built on coal.
There's a little place down in Saline County, in southernmost part of Illinois.
Towns with names like Carbondale and Glen Carbon sprung up generations ago, when immigrants came from Eastern Europe to swing pickaxes and to shovel coal. But fossil fuel markets always swing up and down. And now, with U.S. coal production at a four-decade low, lifelong resident Sam Stearns wonders if the booms are getting outdone by the eventual busts.
That's part of the myth of what I grew up believing about coal, was that there was strictly an upside in terms of the jobs. And I had no idea about what some of the downsides were.
One downside? Fossil fuel production can crowd out other sectors. In good times, demand for workers can push up wages very high and scare away other businesses, say factories. And then in the downturn, there's often not enough public money to invest in something new.
I would like to see these moonscape-looking lands covered with solar panels and windmills. But right now, young folks don't have good prospects around here for jobs.
It's not a given that a resource equals a curse. One way out of it is to tax the mining or the drilling and then use the money to diversify. Illinois doesn't have one of those taxes. Another solution is for workers to retrain to do something else. At the local Italian restaurant Morello's, that doesn't sound very common. Illinois coal jobs have fallen by two-thirds in a generation. Bartender Michael Thomas describes the typical jobless miner.
So like, school ain't for me. I'm a hard worker, I'm a laborer.
These were the big men on campus here, proud men with an appetite for risky jobs and a penchant for fancy trucks.
Big F-150s, new motorcycles, they got boats. And now that the mine is gone, you start to see a lot of people starting to pull back from that. you were on the starting five of the team, and now you just sit in the bench.
And yet the dream of the miner remains. Ethan Dudley is a delivery man at the restaurant, and more important, he's the son of a miner.
And my dad begged me all the time when I was little not to be a coal miner, but that's all I wanted to do, because I see my dad do it.
Some coal jobs could return here, but this is what Ethan Dudley is up against. Technology is replacing workers, and other energy sources are nudging out coal, which could make for an ungraceful decline here.
This is where I got a haircut every Saturday. I remember when there were three barbershops in town.
Resident Sam Stearns drives through the once-thriving coal town of Carrier Mills. That is, until the mine closed. And now it looks like a ghost town.
All these big concrete pads that you see, those concrete pads were businesses. This land has all been undermined here, and it couldn't even support the old brick buildings.
It's a painful pun, undermined, to get at coal's blessing and its curse. In Carrier Mills, Illinois, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Back when I was working the night shift at Marketplace, there were only two of us in the office in the middle of the night. And every once in a while, if we hadn't gotten up from our desks for a minute or two or moved much, really, the lights would go out. One of us would stand up, wave our arms around at the sensors, and presto, the lights would come back on. It got old, believe me. But it turns out sensors in the workplace have gotten oh so much more sophisticated and a tad creepy, too. Rebecca Greenfield wrote about it for Bloomberg. Rebecca, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I need you to tell me about Occupy, and it's E-Y-E at the end. Tell me about that. What is that?
Yeah, Occupy is an unfortunate name for this device. But about a year ago, journalists at the British newspaper The Telegraph came into their offices, and there were these black boxes under each of their desks to monitor if the reporters were at their desks or not at their desks. And the reporters understandably freaked out. Because they were worried that their bosses were basically keeping tabs on them. And less than a day later, HR had taken the boxes away.
Yeah, it is, though, a little bit of the monitoring society, right? I mean, you have no privacy, get over it. And now it's in the workplace, too, in a very tangible way.
Yeah, even though these employees successfully got rid of these boxes, there are sensors all over workplaces everywhere tracking all sorts of things.
Wait, there are?
Yeah, I'm sorry. You're probably being tracked right now.
Tell me about this company called Enlighted.
Yeah, so they make sensors of the lighting type and the energy efficiency control type. And their sensors are pretty inconspicuous. So you walk into an office building and you won't even notice that they're there. So I was at this design firm, Gensler, and they have about 1,000 of these Enlighted sensors in their office. But they're about the size of a dime and they're just embedded in the lights. So you don't even notice it.
The company says they can sort of track how long employees go without talking to each other?
So that's another company called Humanize.
Got it.
Yeah. They're Boston-based, and their sensors are a little more noticeable. They're in a badge that you wear around a neck, kind of like an ID badge. And, yeah, they measure this thing called latency to see how often people are interacting with their coworkers, which to me sounds like a little bit much. But they claim the data's anonymized, and they don't record exactly what you're saying, or at least they don't share that with your employer. But, yeah, the point is kind of so the Boston Consulting Group is using it to see how their office design might encourage employee interactions. You know, they want their employees to be talking to each other a lot. They have all these theories about how that's better for creativity and innovation. So they think that they can use these sensors to better design their space.
You point out in your piece, and this is important to realize, legally speaking, U.S. businesses, you say, you write, are within their rights to go full on Eye of Sauron. That is to say, you got no privacy rights in a modern office.
Basically, someone told me that they can monitor workers all the way up until the bathroom. You have no rights, which you should know about your digital communications, too. Yeah. Basically, anything you do in the workplace, it's kind of your employer's business. So as a workplace reporter, I'm not going to kid myself.
Rebecca Greenfield, she covers workplaces at Bloomberg. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Coming up.
I had no mentors, no nothing, and it was just me kind of just trying to, you know, figure it out.
Turned out pretty well, though. The CEO of Interscope Records straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 32 points today, about a tenth percent, 20,775. The NASDAQ down 5, almost a tenth percent there, 5860. The S&P 500 down about 2 points, shaved off about a tenth percent, closed at 23.62. U.S. home sales rose 3.3% last month, and thus Freddie Mac gained 11.75% today. Bank of America up a tiny fraction. PennyMac Mortgage up 0.75%. Nordstrom down 1.1%. Kohl's elsewhere in retailing showing flat. Bond prices, while they rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.41%. And you are listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Two things about baseball as we continue today. First of all, there was news this morning that the Major League Players Association has agreed to a league proposal to change the rules about intentional walks. No more throwing those four pitches high and outside. Now you can just walk somebody by saying you want to walk them. Maybe this is just me, but that seems not right. More to the economic point, though, Reuters is reporting that Facebook is deep into talks with MLB to stream some games this coming season. Twitter, you might remember, made a bit of a splash last year when it streamed 10 Thursday night NFL football games and says it does plan to expand that this season. So Marketplace's Andy Euler takes a look at the Facebook baseball deal.
Facebook isn't the place where you just post your status or write on someone's wall anymore. It's a media powerhouse, and it knows a lot about its users. Adam Grossman is CEO of Block 6 Analytics, a sports technology and analytics company. He says unlike Nielsen ratings for TV, Facebook can get much more specific information about who's on there and what they're doing, and that's really attractive to advertisers.
So if you actually see a spike in users watching a game, you could create a real-time bidding system where people could buy advertising based on specific times.
Facebook's been testing ads on its live platform for a few months, but it still hasn't figured out how to line up with traditional commercial breaks. David Sternberg, a sports media consultant at Claygate Advisors, says that may not matter to advertisers.
Even if they aren't in a position to run traditional 30-second video spots during these games, there may well be other sponsorship opportunities like entitlement or this inning brought to you by or something like that.
And that's good for Facebook, but also Major League Baseball. Neither responded to our request for comment. Baseball fans traditionally skew older. Again, Adam Grossman.
I actually think Facebook can resonate and help MLB in two ways. One, it does help them expose to a younger demographic. But even as MLB's demographics have aged, Facebook's actually a place where they're going more and more frequently.
Like lots of people. During the fourth quarter last year, the site says it had 1.25 billion daily active users worldwide. Again, great news for advertisers. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The Oscars are Sunday, in case the looming hoopla had escaped you. And every year, the producers of that TV show try gamely to rein in acceptance speeches and run a tighter broadcast. We will see how that goes in this very political year. But it is not just stars, it turns out, in front of the camera who are taking a stand. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports that some of Hollywood's biggest talent agencies are getting political as well.
United Talent Agency is holding a pro-immigrant rally Friday instead of an Oscars party. CAA is hosting a nonpartisan Take Action Day tomorrow. And word is WMEIMG, you might know it as William Morris, is forming a political action committee to support diversity.
This marks a break with the past.
Steve Ross is a history professor at USC. Celebrities, he says, have been outspoken about politics since the days of Roosevelt. But the agencies that represent them, at least up till now, have kept things quieter.
Many of them have gone to lunches, have donated money to the parties, but they've tried to make that their personal decision rather than their business decision.
So why change the playbook? James Andrew Miller is the author of the book Powerhouse about CAA.
One would like to think that it's born out of true conviction, and I think that that's probably true.
But he says
there's another reality, which is that their clients are paying attention now
Stars, they're just like us. They want to know where the brands and companies they support stand, which puts agencies in the same tricky spot many other businesses are in today. How to be relevant, even political, without offending and without scaring off business. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
You hear about plenty of tech CEOs who got their starts in their college dorm rooms, less so for music industry bigwigs. But that's exactly what John Janik did. He started a label called Fueled by Ramen as an undergrad at the University of Florida. Now he's the CEO of Interscope Geffen A&M Records, the company founded by and until the last couple of years run by Jimmy Iovine, if you know that name. John, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
How'd you get the gig at Interscope a couple of years? What is it? 4 years ago now, right?
Yeah, yeah. I had met Jimmy Iovine, who started Interscope. I was coming in to meet him just to talk about music, and he'd show me the Beats headphones.
Yeah,
and I didn't understand what he was doing. I was like,
a lot of people had the same outlook, man. They're like, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, so I just kept in touch with them a little bit. Then one day, Jimmy called me up. The first thing Jimmy said to me was, "You know, I need somebody to run the company. You know, you're going to have the keys to the car. It's going to be your company. I'm going to be here, and I'll help you through everything." Yeah, and I was taken aback. I said, with all due respect, you know, people say things like that all the time. You know, but then I spent the next 9 months with him, and, you know, not many people knew about this, that he wanted to launch a streaming company at the time, and I thought it was brilliant.
What do you make of where music is today? With trying to figure out the streaming thing, artists who, you know, Chance the Rapper, right, wins a Grammy the other day without ever selling a physical record or signing or anything.
Right, right.
It's a tricky spot for you on that.
You know, when I started my label, Fueled by Ramen, you know, it was at a time where the barriers of entry were coming down. You know, you didn't need to have to put, you know, CDs in stores. You didn't have to get on MTV, which was important at the time. But we were able to take advantage of what was happening early on, MP3.com, and then into, you know, Friendster and MySpace, and then into YouTube. So
it's funny because you're not that old, but you, I mean, you know, no, that, I mean, that goes been, back a ways.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing, you know, like I said, I started in 96.
What's the nut you have to crack now?
I think the world on the music side is changing every day. Obviously, streaming's taking hold, you know, but it's still in its infancy stages. I think, you know,
really, it's been around for such a long time.
Yeah, I mean, us living in LA and probably in other major cities. You know, I mean, I've been with my wife since I was 20 years old. I've tried to explain streaming to her, and, you know, probably just a year ago, you know, we're sitting in a car. My you know, he's four at the time. Says, you know, Daddy, I want to hear this song. And, you know, I just pull it up and play it. My wife is sitting in the car and says, oh, you can just do that? You just open something, you click a button, and you can do that? And I was like, yeah, I've been telling you this for 3 years, you know? But I think that's really the world.
And she's married to the guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Talk to me for a second about the decision to release the La La Land soundtrack and how you came to that.
It's an interesting story. I signed Selena Gomez, I guess a couple years ago. And I met through her music agent, her acting agent. And she was telling me about this director she was working with, Damien, and Whiplash. I think it just been put out in the U.S.
His prior film.
Yeah, so she told me about it. And I went and I watched the film at home. And it was one of those movies that just made you think for days after watching it. And I was like, I got to meet this guy. So she fortunately hooked it up. And, you know, I was just like, I told him how much I loved the film and asked him what he was doing next. And he said he was doing this musical. And, you know, we just were like, we got to do it. You know, we put our whole team on it, talking about marketing, you know, what we can help on the music side. You know, he's one of those guys that, you know, he has such a vision. And, you know, it's for us. It's just, okay, how do we just work with him?
It stands to reason, because this is true in all enterprises. But hearing you tell me that story makes it even more clear that, especially in this business, it's who you know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, you bump into things, which again is interesting, because when I was a guy in Florida, you know, starting a record label, I knew nobody. I had no mentors, no nothing, and it was just me kind of just trying to, you know, figure it out. Now, you know, you have this access, and I didn't believe in luck before. You know, now I know it's a lot of hard work, and then there's also positioning yourself.
But the other thing is, you are one of the people now who people want to bump into.
Right.
If that makes it. Oh, come on, man.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it's
you're rolling your eyes. But, I mean, do you ever look around and go,
huh, here I am.
Yeah, totally. You know, I never really look at it that way, but I'm always, like, whenever I'm walking into an event, be like, okay, well, am I going to know somebody? And then fortunately, there's a lot of people there that we work with every day.
In 5 years, what is Interscope, given the pace of change in music and audio?
I think really the sky's the limit. I mean, you think about it, the way that streaming's taking over, there's going to be so many more opportunities to people just to discover new acts. So I think that's exciting. But also I think, you know, what we can just do in entertainment now. I mean, I think that between visual content and, you know, especially when we're working with artists like a Selena or a Lady Gaga, who, you know, was in American Horror Story and she's going to go do A Star Is Born, like finding new ways to connect with audiences, I think is going to be really interesting.
John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was John Janik. He is the CEO of Interscope, Geffen, A&M Records. There is more of our chat on our Corner Office podcast, which is available, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that as I flew into San Francisco this morning, I looked out the right side of the plane and saw out in the middle distance of the sprawl a gigantic circular building. That building is, as of today, officially Apple Park, the company's new, reported to have cost $5 billion headquarters. CEO Tim Cook made the announcement today. It opens for occupancy by workers in April. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 32 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ down 5, almost a 10%. S&P 500 down 2 points, about a 10% there as well. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.